Welcome to the Cohort Sisters podcast, where we bring to life the stories, struggles, and successes of Black women navigating doctoral degree programs and their lives beyond the degree. I'm your host and the founder of Cohort Sisters, Dr. Ijeoma Kola. Cohort Sisters is an online global network empowering Black women pursuing doctoral degrees by providing resources, mentorship, and community. For more information, please visit our website at cohortsisters.com. You're listening to episode 2 of the Cohort Sisters podcast. In today's episode, I talk with Dr. Charisse King, a Neubauer Family Assistant Professor of Linguistics at the University of Chicago. Dr. King, as she playfully refers to herself, discusses her work on how Black speech is perceived and stigmatized, how she transitioned from her undergraduate program immediately into a PhD, and the benefits of doing a postdoc before accepting a teaching position. Let's get into our conversation.
My name is Charisse King. Sometimes I like to play around with the pronunciation and say Dr. King. like a fun little way of making it Black, making it us.
You know? I love it. So where are you from? Where do you live now?
So I'm originally from Rochester, New York, and I went to school in the Bay, but now I live in Chicago.
Okay. My older brother lives, his wife is from Rochester, but he lives in, where was it called? Millport?
You know Millport? Is that upstate?
It's like near Horsehead. I thought it was near Rochester. Clearly it's not, because you're looking at me like, where's that?
Hey. No, it could be one of these smaller places or smaller towns that I don't know well. So yeah.
It is definitely a small town. But I'm always surprised when I hear Black people from there, because whenever we visit him, I'm like, yo, there's nobody here, bro.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So Rochester too, a lot of people don't know that 40% of the population identifies as Black. It's a really Black city. A lot of people would not know just based off of the kind of media discussions of Rochester.
Okay, good to know. What do you currently do?
Yeah, so right now I actually got promoted to assistant professor as a
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you. So I was a provost, a postdoctoral scholar or fellow at the University of Chicago. And so basically that program just brought together different people of color from across disciplines. We had a 2-year postdoc in which we taught of course a year, but could focus on our research because this is an R1. That was the previous one. And then I just got promoted, and that is special too, because it's a name chair. So the Neubauer Family Assistant Professor, which is exciting.
That's awesome. Congratulations again. That's so good. Is there anything else you'd like to share about yourself?
Oh, yeah. Favorite TV show. I love The Golden Girls. Everybody knows this about me. It's like, I know the episodes by heart, like really ridiculous. But yeah, I'm 29 years old, so I'm pretty young in comparison to a lot of my colleagues. I'm one of these people who did the straight through route.
One of the crazy ones like me.
Yes,
but you came out and you look so happy and like you look good.
Thank you so much. Like, I appreciate you saying that, because in the program, I can easily maybe 25 pounds, 30 pounds in grad school.
It's rough. I'm sure people will really love to hear your success story, because I feel like I'm always like the pessimistic, don't do it, but I'm super excited to get more into your story. So now let's go a little bit back. What is your doctorate in?
So my doctorate is in linguistics, and it's from Stanford University, and I specialize in sociolinguistics.
What does sociolinguistics mean?
Yeah, so sociolinguistics looks at language and society and really asks questions about how the ways we speak reflect our identities, where we're from, how old we are, what our gender is, what racial categories we belong to, and it explores the social political consequences of that in the society. So the way people theorize about women's language or Black people's language and things like that are incorporated into questions of sociolinguistics. We're interested in differences and the ways different kinds of people speak.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So what was your dissertation project?
My dissertation project was actually an ethnographic project. I went back to my hometown, Rochester, New York, because I wanted to expand the representation of stories being told about Black life, at least in my field. So the stories about New York tended to focus on what was happening in New York City and tended to focus on the most marginalized populations and the speech spoken among young Black men. But I was interested in telling stories about what was happening up north. Rochester is a part of these Rust Belt regions, and you have this deindustrialization that has happened and really affected the population as well as the economy up there. I didn't see a lot being talked about relative to how African Americans in that space were adjusting to those changes and constructing place identity, given these major social changes and how it affected their speech ultimately. And so I looked at different kinds of personae in that social landscape and looked at the ways in which they took up different linguistic patterns that were local to Rochester or the ways in which they didn't and what it said, whether or not they took them up or not, based on their ideologies and how they oriented to the space.
Okay. I'm also curious, could someone have done that kind of study outside of a linguistics department? Like, could it have been done in like sociology or another social sciences?
Absolutely. I think what makes it linguistics is the portion of it where you analyze the language. I'm also what maybe some would call a sociophonetician. So I study phonetics and I go in and actually study the waveforms and the sound files. And I'm able to look at where the placement of the tongue is just in these clips of speech I have and able to make predictions about the directions in which certain groups are moving or not moving. So that's the only thing that makes it more specific to linguistics, mm-hmm. but the ethnographic part, definitely another field could have done. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you even get involved in linguistics? Like, how did you discover that? Is that a college major? Like, where did that come from?
I'm so glad because it's so random.
I'm like trying not to be. I'm like, but that's low-key random.
Yes, it's high-key random. Like, I get this question all the time. Okay, so I'll go back a little bit. I went to the University of Rochester, but before going there, I went to an arts high school. So I was a creative writing major in high school. And that's important because when I was failing my first year in chemistry, I thought I would be a chemist. And I failed miserably every single exam, by the way. Like, I was happy to make it out of those classes with C minuses and C pluses. So when I was failing, I was like, okay, I'll just go back to my roots, which was writing. Like, I'd always loved writing. And so I took some poetry courses and some English classes. I was like, okay, maybe this feels right. And someone was like, you like science and you like language. You should take a linguistics course because linguistics is essentially the study of the structure of languages. It's a scientific approach to examining languages and what they have in common, how they differ. We ask a bunch of different questions like, how do babies acquire language? How are these languages related? How do people process language? What is a word? What's the definition of that since it varies across languages? And so I took that advice, took a class, and I was like, oh my God, I love this. And it really did combine both my desire to be a scientist, but also my desires to still be connected to language in some way. Mm-hmm.
I love that. That's a nice like marriage of passions and interests. So what are you currently working on? What are you currently researching?
So I research a couple things, actually. The first strand of my research is really about looking at regional variation. I'm really curious as to what it means to be Black in different places and studying how that shows up in linguistic variation, how different people have different slang, for example, or different accents. And it's like, where are you from? Like, those are the kinds of questions I like to study, especially among Black folks, because at least in our field, we're just really starting to get into the research that looks at different ways of speaking Black. So that's one strand. The other one is I like to do sort of the perception and evaluation of this speech. So what does it mean to speak in a way that people index as Black? What are the consequences of it in, for example, the courtroom? And I've looked at this with Rachel Jontel's speech and how the way she spoke, at least in the Zimmerman trial, even though she was the last person on the phone with Trayvon Martin, her stories were discounted. People have come forward from the jury saying that they couldn't understand the way she spoke. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that she was speaking this really stigmatized dialect of English that is racialized as Black. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really interested in studying that as well. In what ways does this inhibit one's opportunities and the kind of benefit of the doubt that they're giving? So yeah, okay. Those are the main strands of my research program.
Interesting. In your field, amongst linguists, is there a consensus for how to describe Black vernacular?
Yeah, I would say I think there is relative to the most stigmatized features. And that has to do with these grammatical items, such as, I'll give you a couple examples. So like habitual be, which is making its way into mainstream American English. But if you're like, he be walking to school, it means, oh, he usually walks to school. That's one example. But you also have instances in which you don't have to use the be form or the inflected be form in a sentence. So if I say, she talking a lot, it's the same as she is talking a lot. But in that particular context, you don't actually have to produce a covert inflected form of be. And so these are kinds of grammatical features that are associated with the dialect that I think everyone agrees on. I think where we get more sort of variation is when we start to talk about the phonetic kind of stuff. So stuff pertaining to the sound system. I think that's where you can get a lot more variation. And especially, like I said, going back to the point about regional variation, I think that's mm-hmm. part of the reason why it shows up that way.
So interesting. I'm so fascinated. Okay, so let us now turn to your journey, your doctoral journey. How did you end up in a doctoral program, especially straight out of college?
I got lucky in that I always knew I wanted to do research. So when I was in high school, I had an internship in a chemistry lab and I just got hooked, right? So I'm like, I want to do research. Eventually, I changed it from doing chemistry research. And I just happened to drop by the office. We had a McNair program, the Ronald E. McNair program. And I asked about their application. And they're like, there's like a 2 or 3 day deadline or something to be in the program. And so it just so happened I was able to get recommendation letters in time and submit for that. And that was really my first exposure to like, knowing about PhD programs in general and learning about the process for doing them. And it was through that program I got paired with a professor who wanted to do research with me. And I was working on something completely different than the research I'm doing now. But again, it was my first exposure. And that professor, I still have a really close relationship and bond with. I did research with him. And from him, he also recommended me for 2 other programs. So I did SROP, so the Summer Research Opportunity Program. I did mine at OSU, but there are other colleges in the consortium where you could do that research. And I also did an experience at UMass with another professor. So as an undergrad, I got 3 different research experiences. And that sort of helped me to get to the place of saying, I definitely know that I want to do a PhD. Because also, I don't know that there is much else I could do with a bachelor's.
Okay. So when you were applying to programs, how did you identify Stanford's program? How did you identify all the programs that you applied to? And how did you figure out that program was the best for you?
Absolutely. Great question. So I actually worked hand in hand with my advisor who was the first person I did research with and said, what are the top linguistics programs? I made a list just by doing a couple of, what do you call it, Google searches of top 10 PhD programs. But then I ran that list by my professor to say, which ones do you think are good? Who do you know there that you think I would work well with for the kinds of topics that I wanted to study, right? And I think that's what's most important. I think sometimes people think getting a PhD is just about studying a particular subject, but you really want to be mindful of who you get the chance to work with, because that's really going to determine, I think, to some extent, how challenging the program is going to be. You want to make sure you're working with someone for whom you have similar kinds of work ethic, as well as you care about the same types of things, or else it's going to be a little harder. It's not impossible, but that's really important. So I did that, and then I went and visited actually each PhD program. I applied to 9 programs, I should say, and I was split. I didn't know if I wanted to do linguistics or speech pathology or education. I applied to 3 different kinds of programs, and that's okay too. I want to emphasize people should if you're unsure, sometimes it's okay to apply and let the cards fall where they may. Mm-hmm. So it actually ended up that I didn't really get into any of the speech and hearing programs at all. But I got into every PhD program in linguistics. And I got into the education one, but I think my heart was more set on linguistics. So there were five programs. I visited all of them, but I actually got the opportunity to visit Stanford twice. So the first time that I visited was an interview, and other universities too had interviews, but mostly it was the case that if you were accepted, you could just come. So I had an interview. I didn't really like the vibe at first. Everyone else had asked me to come out. And Stanford and Yale both said that there were interview processes, while the other schools, it was UMass, UChicago, I got straight into their programs. And the OSU's education program I got into. But at least for Stanford and Yale, they wanted to do interviews in person. Mm-hmm. When I went to Stanford, I did my interviews. It was 2 days of interviews with all the professors in the department. It was pretty grueling, especially for a young 21-year-old Therese. Yeah. But I just committed to being myself, and I'm interviewing them as much as they're interviewing me. That's another thing that people should remember about these programs, right? As much as you're potentially on the chopping block, you want to make sure it's the place that you feel comfortable. And so that was important. I left there, took a flight to New York, a train down to Yale. And as soon as I got there, I was supposed to have interviews, but they were like, "You're accepted." And I was like, "Oh, great." It was a really great feeling that I didn't have to go through what I had just gone through at Stanford. And they were so generous and so kind. And I left them on my way back to Rochester and got the phone call from Stanford with the acceptance. They were like, "We have a diversity weekend coming up. Can we fly you out again?" And I'm just like, absolutely, I want to go to California for a second time. So it was on that trip, because now then they were wanting to look a certain way, right? Mm-hmm. Now they had accepted me. Now they're like, "We want to make sure that you find this a place that you would want to come," right? Mm-hmm. They wanted to look appealing in a certain kind of way. And they did a great job. It convinced me. I'm just like, okay, if you can fly me out a second time, that means you have good funding. And that was important for me. Because I'm just like, I don't want to be struggling in a program. And that's not to say that you shouldn't do a PhD program if it's not like the riches of the schools, right? Stanford is obviously a certain kind of entity with its own large endowment fund. And there are other great programs, but I will say that's one thing that I had to worry about a little less in comparison to some of my colleagues was my funding situation. Mm-hmm. It was always guaranteed. And it was always commensurate with what, I mean, Palo Alto is extremely wealthy. They always made sure to increase every year with inflation. So it was a good situation in terms of that as well. That's one reason why I wanted Stanford. The second reason, which is really super important, is that within the subfields, I had a couple different interests. And I wanted the opportunity or the option to be able to change my mind. Some programs, as you pick that, you're stuck with it. That's what you're doing. Or if you pick this, you're stuck with it because there's no one else here that does the other interest of yours. Mm-hmm. Stanford had people for each of my interests. And there was a degree of flexibility between my qualifying papers to do two different topics. And so that was super important to me as well.
How did you know that, though, when you were applying or when you were making the decision that flexibility was there?
Yeah, so I would ask about what are your requirements up until the point into your ABD. So everyone should know what needs to happen. For some departments, it's going to be, oh, we have qualifying exams. Some departments are going to say we have language requirements. Some want language requirements and qualifying exams or language requirements and qualifying papers. And Stanford was one that said 2 qualifying papers, 2 language requirements, and then your proposal before you are ABD. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good to know what each program will want, because that will help you decide the kind of work that needs to go into it. And if you think you can finish it in the amount of time allotted to you for the completion of your PhD.
Yo, you are so ahead of the game. I literally did not give 1 second of thought to qualifying exams Yeah. When I was getting into these programs, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yes.
You had such good guidance. You knew what you were doing.
I was really lucky. That's why I said it's the McNair program. I had guidance through them. And it was also the guy, Jeff Runner, who I did my research with the first project in college. Yeah.
So you got to Stanford, you made the right decision. Did you have a cohort? Were you by yourself? What was like the program structure?
So we had, I want to say, around approximately 35 students in the program altogether across the years. In a class, they welcome anywhere from 5 to 8 people. Ours was an unusually large cohort, partly because I think they had maybe extra funding. I came in with an NSF graduate fellowship. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing that my advisor had me apply for. So I came in with that, as well as a couple students had like postponed coming in a year. So it was just an unusually large group that year, but it was great. One of the things that I loved about the department was that you don't have the kind of competition that you hear about from other departments, be it in the form of we're competing for funding for next year. Mm-hmm. Everybody was fully funded. And being in the form of, you know, intellectual property, I think people were really supportive. And it was very much of an environment in which I felt comfortable sharing ideas with colleagues and not feeling like I was going to get scooped or anything like that. So that was great. I will say, though, I was the only Black woman in my cohort and really in my program for the most part. Again, linguistics is a random subject. And so, you know, as much as we're like, there are Black folks in STEM, like there are even less. And I'm like, whew, it was difficult. And we had one student who had come back, who was a Black woman. She took some time off, but like a while off, and then came back to finish, but wasn't visible, wasn't around the people who were in the department, really mature and just trying to finish up. So the first Black woman that they let in after me came in my 6th year, and that was difficult.
What are some of the other challenges that you faced as a Black woman in the program?
I think for me, the way that bias can show up, I think, among colleagues or especially among professors, is this benefit of the doubt is not extended to you in the same way that you see it extended to other students. And it's not always as tangible to point out to people. It's just if I were to suggest something versus if someone else were to suggest something, it's, oh, where's your source, right? It's this assumption that I need to prove myself in a different kind of way than I think some other students needed to because they were given the benefit of the doubt. There was a lot of that for me, of course, and imposter syndrome. I don't love that term, but there was a bit of imposter syndrome, I guess you could say. And the reason why I say I don't like that term is because I feel like it places the onus on the people who are most marginalized rather than on the institutions that are doing the marginalization. Like, we don't have the syndrome. We don't have the issue. Mm-hmm. You all are imposing these kinds of...
That's good. That's important.
Yeah, I'm like, it ain't us. So yeah. I like to put agency on the structures rather than on the people. But yeah, so I had a lot of that, as well as I adore both of my advisors, but they were in two different camps a lot of time when it came to theorizing about certain things in the literature. And so it was very difficult to navigate that. Yeah.
Were they cordial with each other, or was it just a professional difference?
They're cordial. Very much it would feel like I was walking a tightrope to try and cater to the needs or the desires of either professor, because your work is a reflection of what you've learned from them. And so if you have co-advisors, both of them want to be able to claim you, but they both probably want you to be able to extend what they're doing in some sort of capacity, right?
Did you have to have co-advisors, or was that a personal choice?
I didn't have to, but for me, the kinds of questions I was studying, it just didn't make sense. They didn't see where they crossed, but I did. And that's what my did, essentially, was to cross them and say, no, actually, what this person's theory is and this person's approaches are the ones I want to use to go ahead and extending this further. So that was really hard to do.
Sounds like it. What are some of your like happiest moments, or what are some successes that you had during the program?
So my happiest moments were always my outreach moments. So I made sure to do a lot of different programs where I could either be TAing a Black Studies class or teaching some sort of readiness workshop for undergrads, applying to grad school, those kinds of things, meeting with my mentees at the time. That was like really key for me because it was my means of connecting, especially with other Black women and other Black people in the university, because there were also no Black men in my department.
Are there any Black men at Stanford? My husband went to Stanford Business School, and whenever I'd go there, I'd be like, it's five of y'all. A whole five of y'all here.
Yeah. So I'm going to answer no. I mean, maybe in education, and history. Sociology, I don't remember there being any, but I mean, that's a symptom of these larger, again, R1 kinds of institutions that really are working to do more diversity efforts, but yeah, gotta put in a lot more effort. So yeah, reaching out through these kinds of programs, absolutely my favorite moments. And I guess conferencing. I love conferencing. The preparation for it could be a bit difficult and not fun, but I loved the opportunity to meet with other scholars in the field and see other Black women through that as well. It was a way to professionalize yourself in a kind of way that you didn't have as much opportunity for as a graduate student. And so seeing how other people viewed me and my own work, I think was essential to my own development as a scholar, because sometimes you can get bogged down in your own department and universities, but it's nice to be among other scholars and have them evaluate your work and bring a new lens to it. I went to at least two conferences a year, at least 2 to 3. So yeah, those were my favorite moments.
Nice. So you said that when you were at conferences, you were able to see other Black women in the field. Did you end up having any Black women on your committee? Do you have any Black female mentors in your field?
No, I didn't have any on my committee, actually. But that's partly because I didn't feel like there was anyone who was doing what I wanted to do. So yeah, there weren't any on my committee. But I would say there were different ones in the field who, just seeing them, they would ask, how are you doing? Is everything okay? With that look that Black women know. Of like, you hanging in there. It was so comforting in different ways. And I don't really reach out to any one specific Black woman at this point in time right now. I think that's probably because I just wanted a sense of freedom after graduating and having dealt with my professors. But I know that they are out there. So if I should have a question and I reached out to them today, I know that there are a set of them out there for whom they would absolutely extend themselves. And I appreciate that.
Nice. So you talked about funding. So you came in with an NSF. You had that for 3 years. And then you said that your program was fully funded. How many years were you in the program? And how did the funding break up?
So actually, my NSF wasn't enough to cover. So they would supplement. At the time, I think it was something like $32,000, and their students were making $35,000. And so they were like, we'll make sure to give you an extra three every year for the first 3 years, but also you'll get, or not an extra three, they just wanted to make sure I was at least on par with the other students. And then they said, we'll also give you an extra $5,000 in research funding that you can use for conference travel and buying research materials. So everybody started off with three, and then I got the five. So I had $8,000 in research funds. That was one of the ways in which they were honoring me bringing in this fellowship. And then after that, I was funded for them, I think maybe 1 year. And then I got a postdoc, not a postdoc, I got a dissertation fellowship. It was called the DARE Fellowship, Diversifying and Recruiting Excellence. And so this was one of those internal fellowships at the university that was another preparation program for a professorate, but also provided a stipend for you. So we had to take a class with them, but we also, yeah, got a little more money. So Stanford maybe paid for me, my department maybe paid for me only 1 year, really. And I was covered from these two fellowships. Let me tell you, I am like the fellowship and scholarship grant girl. Like, I love grant writing. It's something that was taught to me young, and I value it a lot. Mm-hmm. I really do.
Yeah, you are clearly grant queen for sure. So can you talk a little bit more about your postdoc? How did you find the postdoc? Did you apply to like tons of postdocs?
Yeah, so I actually was properly on the job market. And so they came out with this postdoc, but I had applied also for a handful of jobs. I had 5 job talks that I had to give as well. And so this postdoc was a postdoc that was paired with the assistant professorship. So it wasn't just you get the postdoc and then you have to find a job after, which I think is more normal, although people are starting to do more of this kind of attached job. Mm-hmm.
Like a bridge to professor.
Yeah. Yeah. But so when everything was said and done, I had 3 job offers. And the other offers, which were actual professorships, assistant professorships, mm-hmm. came back and said, we'll hook on a postdoc for you if you would like to have more time. Here's the benefit of a postdoc. If you're at an R1 institution, it gives you more time to develop your research program and put things in the pipeline, because you're going to have to adjust to a full-time teaching load. And for me, that's going to be right my first year. I don't want to have to be fussing with getting stuff in the pipeline too, mm-hmm. if I don't have to. So I spent a lot of my time doing research and putting like 5 or 6 things in the pipeline before coming up for reappointment to the mm-hmm. assistant professorship. So yeah, the way that we found it was we have what's called a linguist list, and it lists job posts as well as people. So people mm-hmm. would send notes to my advisors. Do you have any students who you think would want to apply for this? And sometimes it's about straight up asking. There were some people who I went up to and I said, hey, I'd love to postdoc with you. I'm on the market right now. Do you have any opportunities? And they went and knocked on a few doors and said, can we get funding for this? And so sometimes if you have a good relationship with someone who's recognized in the field, they can make things move because they want to help or think that you're a good student.
Those are some pro tips right there. Those are some good gems. Great. So let us move to the last piece. What is your one piece of advice for undergrads who already know they're interested in PhD programs?
Honestly, I would say don't be afraid to take a break. A 1 or 2 year long break in between undergrad and grad school. There were just some things that I felt like I was also learning at the same, a certain kind of socialization that I was learning at the same time as the actual content and material for my PhD. And so learning how to be an adult and pay bills and have a schedule and things like that, I felt my colleagues weren't necessarily acquiring those skills. They were older than me, even if by a couple years, they had already acquired those skills and had time to sort of learn their identity outside of who they were as a student. And I think that space allowed them to be a lot more mature and thoughtful and intentional about how they approached their studies in a kind of way that I think I was mature for my age, but you know, some distance or some space could have benefited me. And so if there's like a 1 year program you want to do, the PhD programs will still be here. So you should definitely take the opportunity to explore that if you're stuck between opportunities.
Mm-hmm. That is excellent advice. I co-sign. When people ask me, I'm like, yeah, it's possible, but you don't have to. Like, there's just no need. There's just no need to it immediately. Great. So is there any other aspect of your journey or your story that you'd like to share that we haven't touched on yet?
Can I talk a little bit about the postdoc a bit more? That program brought in about 15 of us from across departments, the Provost Postdoctoral Fellowship through the University of Chicago. And so I really like that program because I came to Chicago not really knowing anybody and having any friends. And that program was a way for me to meet other professionals at the same stage as me who also looked like me. And so we, you know, we're kind of like, you know, get tenure together. And I think that kind of camaraderie is unmatched. It's unheard of. You rarely hear about those opportunities at other kinds of universities. And I'd like to see more of them. Like, it really has been making all the difference. I do writing groups with these people. They're also who I spend my free time with. And it's just nice to have this kind of community already built into the program I just didn't expect it. I didn't know when I came out here, but I am so grateful for it. It made all the difference. Nice. So if you're at the stage where you're choosing between the kinds of jobs that you want to take, we're in a pandemic, so it's probably maybe not going to be like that. I think you should really think about who else is coming in with you and what other kind of community will you have outside of maybe your department.
That's so important to think about. I'm so glad you shared that. Thank you. Yeah. Now, all of you guys are like assistant professors together.
Yeah.
Oh, cute. It's good to know that there's some opportunities to continue to mentor and foster and really just grow us in our profession. So
yeah.
I'm so glad that you shared that. I'm sure that some people will find that super helpful who are closer to the end of their programs.
Yes, good. And the other thing I want to share is that I'm one of these people who was on the fence about staying or leaving academia. I was just like, I'll apply for the job market once. I'll do one cycle. If it doesn't work out, I'm out. That was just my sort of approach to it. And it worked out this time. And so sometimes if you're on the fence, again, it was the same thing for me for undergrad. I was on the fence about whether I was going to do speech and hearing or linguistics. Mm-hmm. Just let the chips fall where they do. So don't tell yourself no to either opportunities. You let someone else tell you no.
Thank you again for listening to this week's episode of the Cohort Sistas podcast. If you are a Black woman interested in joining the Cohort Sistas membership community, or you're looking for more information on how to support or partner with Cohort Sistas, please visit our website at www.cohortsistas.com. You can also find us on all social media platforms at Cohort Sistas. Don't forget to subscribe to the Cohort Sistas podcast and leave us a quick review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for joining us this week, and we'll catch you in next week's episode.